Good morning and welcome to the October 2002 term of the South Dakota Supreme Court being held here at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. We'd like to acknowledge schools attending this morning, Faith High School, Rapid City Central High School, and various representatives from the courts. If you have not already picked up, we have several publications available for free. First one, which has the South Dakota Supreme Court seal on it, tells you a little bit about each justice and also gives you a brief synopsis of each case we will be holding oral argument on during our term of court here. Secondly, there is a book with a blue cover which gives you a short written description of the South Dakota legal system. And finally, we also have just off the press a photographic history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. All these are available as you come in or leave here. This morning, the first case for oral argument is the State of South Dakota versus John Jolly. Mr. Michael Stonefield, an attorney from Rapid City, representing appellant John Jolly. Ms. Ann C. Meyer, an assistant attorney general representing the City of South Dakota. Mr. Stonefield, you may.
Just a brief discussion of the facts of this case. At the end of July of 2000, Mr. Jolly's son, 6 years old at the time, Mr. Barrett, was assaulted, badly beaten, died from this beating. Within hours, Mr. Jolly, his girlfriend at the time, her name was Carrie Luby, both arrested for child abuse and charged for second-degree murder. They were co-defendants in this case from July of 2000 until April of 2001. In April of 2001, Carrie Luthi took advantage of a plea offer given to her by the Pennington County State's Attorney. She pled guilty to counts of child abuse. She agreed to testify against John. In exchange for her part of this plea offer, the dismissal of the murder charges. She did testify at the trial. She was, in my opinion, the state's primary key witness, Mr. Jolly. Her testimony was that over a period of about 4 days, beginning on a Thursday night, Jolly began to beat his son. Thursday night, he beat him. Friday night, next night, Friday night, in an action that she described as a headbutting, which caused what she described as a serious, large bruise on his forehead. And on the following Sunday, she described in her testimony in detail at the trial a savage by John Jolly, his son, which went on, she described, for hours. And by Sunday night, this boy was, she agreed, serious physical pain. The testimony of the pathologist who testified at this trial was that he was essentially in the process of dying. On Monday morning, which was the last day of July of 2000, authorities were finally called, 911 was called. Medical responders came to the house. The boy was beaten to death. Died, pronounced dead that Monday. The state's case against Mr. Jolly, as I said, in my opinion, primarily came from the testimony of the jury. Now, in this appeal, I have raised three issues. I don't know that I'm going to be able to talk about all three of them today, but I'm going to try. try to focus on these first two and three. They both deal with issues involving evidence about Terry Luthi, about this plea offer that she entered into. The trial court kept her.
Reading through the testimony, the court allows the cross-exam regarding that. Her as the fact that she entered into this plea and the benefit she got and the testimony wasn't effective. And you got a substantial reduction. You got the murder charge dropped against you as what you stood to be sentenced to. And it capped out at a maximum of 20 years. Is that right?
Yes.
And you were allowed to examine and cross-examine that witness in regards to that, except you weren't allowed to ask her solely whether or not she could have got a life sentence. Is that what the trial court limited you on?
I think
so now,
that's accurate.
And you're talking then, is that just saying, like, you weren't allowed to have a effective cross-examination?
What I was not allowed to do on that issue, the second issue in the brief, was I was not allowed to ask her to present to the jury what it was, the full extent of what it was that she received. What she received from this plea bargain was the dismissal of a charge, actually two alternative charges, that carried mandatory life sentence.
Well, I'm not talking about the sentence. You've got to tell the jury that she got two murder charges dropped, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
So now, where is, as I read it on cross-examination, there's a discretion on what the trial court can allow in. And as I understand it, Logan Reeves cases, it's effective cross-examination. It isn't what you actually think would be effective. So now, what was the error on the part of the trial court? And how were you prejudiced?
Prejudice here, Justice Hamilton, and I think it's borne out from the cases that I've cited. Cases from Georgia, from Alabama, cases that including Stark's case, the Wolfson case, these are in my brief. They talk about, Wolfson in particular, called the sentence that the testifying person receives. Here, a former co-defendant, they call the sentence that the person would have possibly received to be the most important aspect of the plea agreement.
Do you have significance to the fact this was life of the whole versus the
Oh,
been the maximum.
Absolutely.
What's that significance?
Life without parole being something, what my client is serving right now, something that gives him no possibility of ever being released short of some type of executive intervention. Terry Luthi, as part of this deal, took pleas to two offenses that gave her maximum of a term of years, 20 years. That's not even what she received. She received less than that. But what she was facing was a mandatory sentence of life in prison. Something from, as I said, from which she would not have the possibility of peace in her life. She received, and I think the cases that I've cited to you bear this out, she received an enormous concession. The cases...
enormous concession. You were allowed to cross-examine on the concessions you got. You were allowed to examine her saying you've got to plead to abuse, of child abuse, versus murder. Were you allowed to cross-examine
her
on that?
Yes.
And you were allowed to argue to the jury that she bought and sold and got a good deal. You can't believe her. Were you?
Yes, I was.
And you argue that strenuously.
I did. Not
and the jury
that.
Found her credible, notwithstanding, right?
Well, the jury found her credible enough to return a conviction. I'll say that. They found her credible, of course.
Go ahead.
I believe I phrased my questioning here essentially in the way. said, something to the effect of what she was facing here was substantial. We're facing a lot less. I think, Your Honor, I think what the jury needs to know is how good it is. Without them having heard exactly what she got here, exactly where she came from, way up here, something way down here, without them knowing exactly the extent of what she got, I don't think it's fair to say that they told, they really got a flavor of what it was that she received.
Are you telling me a jury wouldn't understand that child abuse is substantially way up here, down to here?
I'm not saying that they wouldn't understand that, but, you know...
What then? That would they understand?
It raises a question in my mind. If we think that the jurors are going to have some kind of inherent knowledge that she's already receiving something enormous here and they really don't need to be told exactly what it was, what would the harm have been of letting them hear it?
Well, no, I'm just saying, I don't know if they're being... We have to look at whether or not it seems to me that you have to give some credit to them for knowledge that quite a difference between murder and child abuse.
Certainly I would say that.
And then wouldn't they also know what the instructions were as far as what the murder was?
Yes, they will.
They had all that information.
Again, though, not the full extent of the deal. Absolutely.
And you say, jury know that?
I think that under the facts of this case, this witness's credibility is so key to this case. Looking at the objective thing that we can make about the jury delivery in 24 hours. Is it possible that could have tipped them over? Knowing where she came from, what she was originally facing, who would stand, not just that she was something, who would stand for what she was.
Do you think that the jury was aware, or do you concede that the jury knew that she was facing murder charges?
Oh, sure.
And that they were dropped, and then that she got two convictions on child abuse.
Yes.
So they knew that. Don't you think that the jury would know you can get a life sentence for murder?
I would think that some people on the jury may have that knowledge, whether they would know that degree of murder she's facing here, which is not first degree, second degree murder, or alternative counts here, including felony murder counts. They have known that a felony second degree murder count would carry in this state a sentence of mandatory life. It's fair to say that they would have had that. But even if someone had it, it's something they're bringing into deliberations. And again here...
Did you argue to the court that you should be allowed to argue to the jury that she had murder charges dropped, which could have provided life or life in prison without parole?
I don't know that I said that specifically in the argument that took place over this issue. This issue was raised by the state's attorney during the middle of the trial. I don't know that I specifically said that in the trial court. I think I did make it clear that I wanted to be able to. I wanted their motion, which was about Johnny's potential sentence, not to cover what Luthia faced.
Let's see if there's
procedurally, hadn't Lupe already pled guilty?
Yes, she had pled guilty. She had not yet. I want to talk some about the first issue in the brief. That first issue deals with evidence that I had attempted to get introduced to the jury regarding conduct of Terry Lupe, prior assaulted conduct, which would have been testified to by a person, it's John Jolly's sister-in-law, a person who had known Terry Lupe. She would have testified that she had in the past seen Terry Lupe assault three different men, including one of which being Warren's husband. Now, I wanted that evidence to come in relevant, that it was evidence which could have gone to establishing another perpetrator, constitutionally protected evidence which any defendant has the ability to introduce, present a complete defense, if relevant, shown that it was relevant. Now, we did a hearing on this evidence, and I think I pointed out clearly in the brief exactly what it was that wanted to come in the pretrial transcripts.
Any of that evidence dealing with
abuse of the
child?
No, granted, not.
Didn't the court not change and settle this issue?
I don't believe so, Your Honor,
despite a dissent.
If you're talking about similarity issue,
right.
Okay. Similarity issue here, I think similarity can arise in this context on both the relevance issue and on the 403 issue. But relevance as defined by statute and as defined by case law, as talked about by case law from this court, is an extremely low burden. It's evidence having any tendency to make a fact an issue more or less relevant. And what was the fact at issue in this case? The fact at issue in this case was killed this woman. Justice Kornkamp, I think I know what you're getting at here, that this is somehow an assault on the character. He's trying to get this into his character. And as you know from the case law, anytime any party is going to attempt to introduce 404B evidence, character is almost always going to arise as part of the equation. Could this have impugned for character? Absolutely. I don't understand. But as I said, almost any time you can introduce this kind of evidence, even part of the character is trying to speak, it's going to impugn. It can't help it.
She had already pled.
Yes, she pled. Yes.
Were you allowed to use that?
Yes, I was. But the significance of this was the assaultive behavior, including beating someone up, including punching them in the stomach. This boy was beaten. He was physically beaten with hands and fists.
Was this evidence of such a character?
I don't know that I would. I don't think it's fair to characterize it that way. No. But
what you're saying is that she had a capacity to assault.
She had assaulted people. And back to the issue that you had raised, Justice Gilbertson, the similarity issue. I think the key distinction here, and why Mueller doesn't control this case, is because this is evidence being offered by a defendant, not against him. The case law that I've cited in brief here is a number of cases that have talked about this issue draw a distinction. There's a distinction to be drawn when this evidence is offered by a defendant. The prejudice test, prejudice test that we look at under 403, it's not the same. It just doesn't, we don't have to do the same thing. don't have the danger here. This trial did not pose the danger of a defendant being unfairly convicted because of the character. Third-party perpetrator instruction?
Yeah.
I didn't propose one.
You didn't? Why would you?
I don't know that there's a pattern.
But you mentioned it earlier, that you said my third-party perpetrator was denied opportunity.
So
never was offered an instruction.
No, it wasn't.
Did you argue it?
That she had possibly done this. Oh, absolutely. That was the part of her lack of credibility and responsibility.
She did get in.
I got in the fact that she had pled guilty to having abused him. And what she pled to was that on that Sunday morning, the second to last day of his life, that she had struck him. That was the daughter. She also pled guilty. The second count that she pled guilty to was abusing the daughter. But again, when we talk about similarity here, I think the case law is clear on this, and I would ask the court to adopt this in its decision here, to follow the authority from any other jurisdiction.
Time has expired.
So you're saying that we should have a lower threshold when it's offered by the defendant?
Case law from many other jurisdictions has adopted a lower threshold. Yes. I think that's reasonable.
Who wants to?
Well, I think, Justice Stinner, that it's probably more accurately coming in under 404B. There was no attempt here to keep this evidence out as improper third-party perpetrator evidence.
Stand.
Sure. Well, that may be, but as I said, I don't think that there was any attempt here to keep it out as third-party perpetrator evidence. It was so clear here that this woman had the opportunity to have done these acts, which is a significant part of what third-party perpetrator evidence is. I guess I'd finish on that just by saying that if you feel that it should be addressed as the third-party perpetrator rule, I point to object to that. Yep, it should have come in.
Time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
My name is Ann Meyer, Justice General, representing the state in this matter today. We're going to begin by quoting Justice Sabers. The jury in this case wasn't born yesterday. They knew that Luthi was facing a severe sentence. It's just common sense that murder is going to be a higher charge than child abuse. The defense adequately explored this plea agreement and the terms of the plea agreement, everything except the sentence at trial. Simply because she was going to draw her last breath in prison, possibly. Remember, she had not been sentenced at the time of trial. So it's still conceivable that she could have gotten a lesser sentence, which she did. She got a lesser sentence. So the evidence about her.
They were allowed to examine her about this 20 years past.
Exactly. Yes, you're allowed to. She indicated that she had pled down from two murder counts. She was facing a maximum of 20 years. So the jury was well aware that she had been in deep trouble, They knew that she was going down the scale. There's no way that that could be, you know, this jury would not have been any more enlightened if the simple detail that she was facing a life sentence had come in.
Why was it objected to by the state? Why was the state so adamant that he couldn't go into that kind of detail?
Well, there are many cases. I know, I think we've cited them, or there is a line of cases that we've cited in our brief, which say that it creates sympathy for the defense because you have two defendants, one's a co-defendant, that are both facing the same life sentence.
It may be, but it's not improper. It's not improper sympathy for the defendant.
Well, I guess the state's position would be that it is, because it creates this. It's this tool that the defense uses to create sympathy for the defendant.
Well, it also tends to show that she may have lied in order. She may have lied, and she may have put the blame onto him in return for a lighter sentence.
Just. That's in our state. It's well settled law that the sentence is for the child. Regardless of all the states that he's named here, you know, whether it's Georgia, Alabama, Iowa, Michigan, in our state, and the trial court was taking that approach, sentencing is not a matter for the court. It's not a matter for the jury. It's the responsibility of the court. And go back to your question. The reason the state was trying to avoid sympathy for the defendant was precisely because of what defense counsel mentioned here today, that both co-defendants were not trial counsel. That's part of the whole equation. So we didn't want to interject sentencing into the jury's decision in this matter. If there are no further questions on the second issue, I want to move along to the first issue. Simply because Luthi struck her old romantic boyfriend doesn't mean that she committed murder in this case. All of his cases show that similarity is a key component.
Why isn't it credible evidence for the jury to consider? In other words, they had evidence that Luthi was a person of a violent character. She either struck out violently out of frustration, out of boredom, out of inability to win an argument or something, in several different instances. And she might very well do the same thing as far as this child is concerned if she's frustrated or bored or just has a tendency towards violence. Why isn't that admissible?
Because the trial court found you have dissimilar victims. You have adult males.
Well, the victim maybe
quarrels.
Is never going to be similar. I mean, there's a difference in age. There's a difference in name. But how important is similarity?
Because we don't try anyone on the basis of character evidence. But the defense is putting it in. First prior bad acts evidence were when
the state were putting this evidence in against the defendant, you know, you'd be arguing absolutely the opposite end.
No, I don't think so. Based on Moeller and Chum, you wouldn't be arguing. You don't have the same type of relationship. She wasn't acting as a mother when she beat her. That's a whole different group of people. It's a different class of victims.
Was she acting like a mother when she committed child abuse, which she pled to on her child?
Well, it was not her biological child. Boyfriend's son. And that's a closer context because it's the same child victim.
So those are all distinctions without a difference, aren't they?
No, they're not distinctions without a difference. This court said in Moeller and Shomley, you look at that, you look at similarity, it's a key part of the equation. Don't drop it out. You look at the relationships, the type and class of people that you're dealing with. So we disagree with that.
Trials are supposed to be checked.
Yeah.
That's not perfect.
Right.
Doesn't it seem a little strange that in this proceeding, the state was allowed to bring in another act against the defendant you're talking about here regarding the parsing of the mother or something and mother? Because there's an element material to the issue that remains that just doesn't seem fair to me, does it?
There's no case law or no statute that says everybody but the defense gets to, you know, only defense gets to put in character evidence. It's the same test. It's the same test for both sides. The defense doesn't have any more leeway than the state.
So you're saying in this record that the trial court jumped through all the hoops determining whether or not evidence relevant, whether or not it was more prejudicial to the program. So the record reflects an adequate dissection of all those events.
That's correct. He even cites the parties to looking at East Davies Shomley. Everything is covered by his on the record balancing effort that he put out there. And the state's evidence was different because it was the same child in the same family. It's the victims of her sister. It's the same class of victims and the same type of physical abuse. So you're using the same standard to differentiate between the type of evidence that the defendant is offering. And his evidence was pure character evidence. He wants to show that Luthi was a bad person or a bad woman simply because she punched her old boyfriends. And there's a different tension going on there. Some of those boyfriends...
Doesn't go to the issue of identity of the perpetrator.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. Exactly.
Proper.
Yes, and that was a hotly contested issue here. But I will point out, as defense counsel noted, that Luthi took the stand.
Are you saying what they wanted to offer went to that issue of identity?
Yes, that's the exception.
Then why would it go in?
Because they're not the same victim. They're not the same type of behavior. She's not acting as a mother when she's hitting her boyfriends. Simply because she whacked one of her boyfriends with a curling iron, that's in because he came in late being drunk. That's not the same. You can't impute that to the type of abuse that
there
Barrett
is more
suffered.
Similarity.
No, because that is an isolated incident at the time that had to do with the relationship with that particular husband. That was 13 years ago before this little boy was beaten to death. Simply because I beat my boyfriend 13 years ago does not mean that I killed my boyfriend's child 13 years later. It's a different type of victim, and it's a different type of relationship. There's not the same type of, I guess you'd say, sexual tension between the boyfriends, type of turbulent relationships that she's having with them and this young child. It's two different types of people, two different classes of victims, two different types. Well, we've got case law from both sides. We've got cases that he cited, and some of which I've referenced in my brief, which says that the defendant gets a lower standard of admissibility on the prejudicial prong. And this court looked at that in State v. White and decided that you don't have to get to the prejudicial prong until you find similarity. Even his own cases, United States v. Stevens, says the crucial key is similarity. No matter how you look at it, from the defense's reverse prior bad acts perspective or from the state's perspective, is still similarity, and they didn't
have it. Was State v. White the case where they were trying to bring in where the victim had that pornographic material in the trailer house or something?
There's another White case like that. The White case that we have cited in our brief, I think, is Melvin White. It has to do with a prior assault.
Further questions from the bench?
We'd ask that you affirm the defendant's
decision. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Stonefield, you have 10 minutes, sir. The state argued in the brief that other acts of this that I want to not show. That may be a what I want evidence of this type that I'm evidence was not relevant. The first test that you have to do
ask you this, as far as when you say the evidence that went in probably was that the defendant here and both lived in the same prison. Both were there on occasion alone or together. Calling your client about him wanting to go to the triggered this, supposedly?
Well, her argument for Dolly's motive to kill his son was that Derek Dolly had, in a few days, had said something to him.
Wanted to go look at grandma and grandpa, right. And they had no relationship, mother and father with the son. Yeah. And so all that went in. Now, what more do you need to make sure? You made your argument based upon the fact that she was there, she was convicted, pled guilty.
She pled guilty to, if there can be such a thing, what I think is fair to term, innocuous child abuse. Setting a child in a tub of water or slapping a child. She entered it. Even when she entered her pleas, she really entered her pleas. She never really.
Were you allowed to cross-examine her as far as what she has done? Was she able to prove that she's done anything?
I was
as far as on striking others and what she did. You aren't precluded from doing this.
I didn't get into anything further than simply the fact that she had that. That been convicted or had admitted.
So there wasn't anything else that was a trial court denied to use so her actual conduct relating that child.
I think that's
it. She so that the children she could work with her, maybe clay, and club, she's acting, and all that way as far as how she treated that.
There was. I want to come back to the similarity issue we talked about, and I think it's really. Ms. Meyer has said that she referenced the Stevens case in particular, but saying that similarity is such a direct quote. U.S. v. Stevens is page 1405, where the court says, while we readily concede that the attacks are by no means signature. This is simply similarity, as I was saying before, similarity when it's being offered by a defendant attempting to present it does not happen to this time. Many other cases talk about that and discuss the reasons why. The main reason which it, I believe is that we do not here, put a defendant prejudice of being convicted because of his parents. This was not a dream. She was not here solely for the parents. And I strenuously disagree that the only reason that this was offered was a parent. And there was character, pure character evidence that was known about. It was not offered because it would have simply been apparent. This evidence is relevant to our defense. Would it have impinged on your character? Absolutely.
Saying of the identity.
Yes. Perpetrator. As did the prior acts that were introduced against John Jolly. The fact that he had earlier assaulted his daughter. That impinged on his character. Trial court let it in.
So what you're saying then is basically you weren't allowed to argue to the jury that this woman had struck adult male and that would have been a arrow in your quiver to shoot as far as to raise a reasonable doubt. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes. In the context of this case, and we can't remove ourselves from the context. This was a beating, a physical beating. wrists and hands, including as a pathologist testified. Injuries to Barrett Jolly's stomach could have been fatal. Could have been killed. Remember, Carrie Lucas testified that John had said to her on Sunday, "I hit him so hard that I thought my fist was cut." The state, of course, tied that back in to the seriousness of the stomach injury. And he said, Justice Anderson, a reference in closing argument on his weight vector versus the ability to find it. Now, again, coming back to the context of this, we have a woman. Just as in the on the second issue, where you may say that the jury may have been able to know the seriousness that she was facing, is it not unreasonable here to think that all things being equal, man with like is that not something that in the context of this case makes this more relevant, and I think we're past relevance. I think we're up to 403. Should, if relevant, should something else have kept this evidence out? Under 403, what keeps something out? Well, there's a laundry list, but I think that really the only factor there would be unfair prejudice is not going to be able to contain this. It's not going to contain the issue. Crystal clear. That was the issue. U.S. v. Stevens is 935, Fed 2nd, 1380, page 4.
What circuit court of appeals? Okay, thank you. Well, of course, bad act. Isn't on truck. You're saying that bad acts doesn't even apply because you should be able to cross-examine, bring out whatever you want as far as for what purpose. What are you offering
identity
for?
Identity of the perpetrator. And not, Your Honor, anything that I would want to do. Because you still have the standard here of 401. You still have the standard of relevant. Let's remember, as this court said in State versus.
You got her there all these times. Got her admitting to child abuse. You got all this in there. What more does this add? Other than that she admits hit some fella in the stomach.
This adds the type of acts that she was guilty of. The acts that she pled to, putting a child in a bathtub of water and striking him with a belt could not have been. These acts could have been guilty. That's why it was so important. Now, if relevant, what's their next step?
Your time has expired, counsel. Court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.